Well, it's always good to come together and worship God, and I'm glad for this opportunity to teach this afternoon. So, Paul finally arrived in Jerusalem, and he was received by the brethren. He gave them a good report. He told them what God was able to do through him in his ministry to the Gentiles, and all the success that he was able to enjoy the fruit. And the Jewish Christians were thankful for that. And they responded to him with a request. Many Jews believed the gospel. Some of the Jews were still zealous of the old law. And we've mentioned and studied some of the issues that the early church had to work through. The circumcision debate was already settled by God, and it was articulated by apostles and by inspired men. And these Jews understood that the Gentiles were members of the church, had every right to be members of the church and having their sins washed away. And they were not required to submit to the old law as long as they left idolatry and followed Jesus. Acts 21, verse 25. But they still had some hang-ups and maybe scruples, maybe you can call it that. And they asked Paul to go with four men who had a vow to be purified with them and to pay their temple tax. Now, Paul did this because he knew that this did not violate the Christian system, and it would be an occasion for him to bear with brethren and for the sake of unity and for the sake of loving his brother. And so he did that, hoping that he'd have more influence among the people at this time as he was, we talked about this, he was coming to Jerusalem with some important tasks. One of the important tasks would be to make distributions to the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, when Paul was taking care of this request that they had made, Paul was in the temple before the days of purification ended, hostile Jews found Paul. And they stirred up the people with a lot of uninformed accusations about Paul. And they dragged him out of the temple and began to beat him. Now the commander, who we later read is Claudius Lysias, received word about the commotion, and he used soldiers to bind Paul, and he asked what he did. What did this man do? And the crowd gave very conflicting answers. They couldn't agree with one another. Very similar to Trials of Jesus. But I think this is just a pattern of people in commotion and confusion. And they couldn't agree on their accusations against Paul. So the Romans secured him from the mob. And at this time, you can feel the tension in this moment. There was great emotion, and it was coupled with confusion. And that is never a good combination. But that was the combination of the time of the people. They were all stirred up against Paul. And then we arrive to our group of verses. If I was to just use one word to describe the group of verses that I'm covering, it would be this transition. So this group of verses is basically a transition from Paul's encounter with the Jews to his defense or series of trials and defenses. Paul begins his defense of the Jews, and we're only going to cover that transition scene and then just a little introduction from Paul, and then we'll be all done. So it's really just some transition verses here. Paul's trials would include time before the chief priests and the council, and it would include a plot to kill Paul. And you remember his nephew giving word to the Roman commander and them taking Paul away from that dangerous situation. It includes a dialogue with Felix, with Agrippa, with imprisonment all through these stages. It includes a shipwreck and a voyage to Rome. And that's really starting in chapter 22 and going really to the end of the book of Acts. Through all this time, there's this underlying issue. Paul is going through trials and He's been falsely accused by the Jews, and he is defending himself while also preaching the gospel at the same time. Paul maintained his innocence, and I think it's remarkable that he used these opportunities again to defend not only himself, but to defend the faith and preach the gospel. So in Acts 21, our verses that we're covering is Acts 21, verse 37, and we go to Acts 22, verse 5. So chapter 21, verse 37, all the way to chapter 22, verse 5. I'm going to read the first couple verses. Acts 21, verses 37 and 38. Then, as Paul was about to be led into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" He replied, "Can you speak Greek? Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" So Paul was about to be led into the barracks. What are barracks? If you don't know what barracks are, you're in good company. I didn't understand exactly what that meant. And barracks are basically, they were the headquarters of the Roman soldiers at the time. And it's entered that word is mentioned in verse 34 and now in verse 37. But specifically, it is the Antonia Fortress that they're talking about. This was located on the northwest corner of the temple, and Herod rebuilt this fortress and named it after his friend Mark Antony. So that's why it's called Antonia Fortress. And it towered over the temple area and allowed the Roman soldiers to monitor and control any riots or any conflicts. So it's kind of like a little wall, almost looking like a castle. And it was the Roman soldiers and the commanders occupied this area, and they used it as a lookout post. And they'd look out among the people, make sure everything's going all right. They would go take matters into their own hands if it wasn't. And so they were going to, they grabbed Paul, and they were leading him to this this fortress so that he would not be killed by the Jewish mob. And as we read in the last study, in chapter 21, verse 35, there were stairs that led up to this little fortress. And as a matter of fact, things were so crazy at the time with the mob trying to hurt him that the soldiers just had to grab him, take hold of him, and take him up those stairs to get some separation from the mob. So the stairs would lead up to a door that could be, you know, shut, and it could be secured from people coming in and hurting anyone. And so their goal was to get him away from the crowd. And while they were doing that, while he was about to go inside this fortress, then he asks the commander, well, who is the commander? And what does that mean, commander? Well, a lot of people also use this word, kiliarch. And this comes from the original word in this in Greek, which is kiliarchos. And this means a commander of 1,000 or a chief officer. And we learn later that this is Claudius Lysias, who would later send Paul to Felix with a letter, according to Acts 23, verses 26 through 30. And we know this man Lysias, the kiliarch, we know he obtained his Roman citizenship by purchase. Because you remember, later it'll be covered that they were beating Paul, and he made defense and appealed to his citizenship. Is this the right thing to do to beat a Roman citizen? And then that's when he answered and said, well, with a great sum of money, I purchased this privilege. And he said, but I was freeborn. That's what Paul said. So he purchased his Roman citizenship. So he was probably a Greek, according to Acts 22, verse 28. And we noted how tense the situation must have been. In the midst of all of that, Paul seems very calm and collected and smooth and ready to give a proper defense. Paul's first request was to speak to Lysias, and he effortlessly spoke Greek to him. And it's important to understand that he spoke Greek to this man, and this astonished Lysias. The character Lysias accused him of being would not be able to speak Greek. That's the point. He was an Egyptian, and he would not be able to speak Greek the way that Paul was speaking to him. And I think his request first to talk to Lysias was really ultimately a permission. He wanted to ultimately speak to the Jews, and that's what he asked for. That's what he'll ask for in the next verse or two. So the accusation again. What's that accusation? I'll read it one more time. Verse 38. Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness? So the accusation made by the Kiliarch shows how confused he was about the situation. Think about this. He's just coming into this this mob, beating this man, not really knowing what's going on, but having a feeling that this is not the right move, and they need to step in and allow justice to proceed. And so he's thinking, why would they be beating this man? Why would they be so enraged? Well, is he that false prophet, that Egyptian, who convinced people, stirred them up, started a rebellion, and left Jerusalem? Is he that man? Surely it's someone like this who would cause an uprising. Surely there must be something serious going on. Now, Josephus and Luke disagree on the number of people that were led out to the wilderness by the Egyptian. According to verse 38, Acts 21, verse 38, there was 4,000 assassins or cutthroats that were led out of Jerusalem. Josephus says there was 30,000 who were led out to the Mount of Olives. Now, there could be a number of explanations here that could answer this discrepancy. For one thing, there's a chance that this was not the same rebellion. You think about it. Already in Acts 5, verse 36, Gamaliel mentions this, another rebellion of people being led. And this was commonplace. You know, Jesus promised that this would be commonplace. These things would be happening. But when these happen, he said, this is not the sign of the end or of the destruction of Jerusalem. There was one sign that would happen when it's surrounded by the abomination of desolation. Anyways, he was saying that there would be many people in these times that would say, look, there's Christ. Look, there's Christ. Lots of false prophets going on. So there's a chance that this could be a different rebellion that he's talking about. Or Lysias could only be referring to the people who are able to fight. You remember, a lot of times Israel was counted by, they counted him or was numbered by the people that, the soldiers that were able to fight. And there could be women and children and other people not qualified to fight that weren't counted with that number. You remember Jesus feeding the 5,000? There's more families involved. Sometimes they're just talking about one group of people representing the whole, but that doesn't mean that is an entire count of every being. So there could be a lot more people. That could have been another explanation. Either way, we can trust Luke's account. The affair was fresh on Lysias' mind, and Linsky says that the rebellion, he's taken on that verse and saying that the rebellion happened some days before this. So this was fresh on his mind, and he was thinking, I've stumbled upon it. I found the man. I found this really dangerous man. And that makes sense. That's probably the reason why he chained Paul up with two chains, because he thought, this is a scary fellow I got hold of here, and I need to bind him up, because he could be doing damage in no time. So he quickly understood that Paul was not this Egyptian when he spoke Greek to him. So verses 38 through chapter 22, verse 2, first part of that verse, it reads, but Paul said, I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people. So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs and motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great silence, he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, saying, and that's verse chapter 22, brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now. And when they had heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. So Saul was of Tarsus of Cilicia. So Paul appealed to his citizenship to garner the respect of the Kiliarch. Cilicia was a Roman province, and Tarsus was the capital of that province. So because of its strategic location, the Cydnus River was navigable only to the port of Regma at Tarsus, where several of the most important roads of Cilicia converged, it became one of the most prominent places in Asia Minor, developing important commercial and social relations with other cities and countries. So this was no mean city. What does he mean by that? Well, again, the CSB translation helps us understand this too. He says, I'm a Jewish man from Tarsus of Cilicia, a citizen of an important city. Now I ask you, let me speak to the people. So he's saying, I didn't just come from nothing. I came from this prominent city. You ought to be able to, you have respect for this, where I came from, and allow me to speak to the people. And Lysias gave him permission. There seems to be many people who are waiting for an explanation, as is the case with lots of mob situations. I imagine many people really didn't know exactly what was going on, but they were caught up in the moment, in the emotion, and they were part of this mob, and they wanted answers. So Paul motioned for the crowd to quiet down, and as he prepared a defense, as he did this, he was ready to give a defense of himself and of the gospel. And he spoke to them in Hebrew dialect. Most footnotes state that this is Jewish Aramaic that he's talking about. And that's the common dialect spoken by Palestine in the first century. And that's really largely, I think, what Jesus spoke during that time when he talked to, when he was living and preaching. And so Paul spoke in this dialect as well. Paul didn't have to speak in Jewish Aramaic. Most of the Jews understood Greek and would get the point if he talked to them in Greek. Lysias and the Roman soldiers that were protecting him couldn't understand Aramaic. So this was a very vulnerable and humble decision, a humble move of respect from Paul. He's kind of opening himself up, and the Romans couldn't hear or couldn't really understand what he was saying, but he chose to still risk that, because he wanted to reach the Jewish audience. And it worked. He was in the temple. He spoke the language of the people. And according to verse 2, this made them all the more silent. They were like, well, let's really hear what he has to say. He's speaking in our dialect. He's showing us respect. And Paul preached in many interesting places. Really, he preached wherever he was. He was in many interesting and strange locations. But this situation, I think, is one of the strangest. Think about this. He was at the top of these steps, right by the Antonia Fortress, and you had this mob here that wanted to beat him up, maybe kill him. And he was preaching to them while being guarded by Roman soldiers, by the Achilliarch, by the centurions. And still, he was ready to preach, no matter how strange the situation was, and I think that's remarkable. His defense was brilliant, as usual, and it was adapted to the audience. The first five verses of chapter 2, verses 2 through 5, Paul appeals to his Jewish roots, where he's from, and he wanted to strike familiarity and relatability with the audience. Then verses 6 through 16, Paul's conversion to Christ. And then verses 17 through 21, you have Paul's mission to the Gentiles. Paul didn't have to address the charges against him. As a matter of fact, he didn't directly address all of his charges. That wasn't necessarily. All he did was he simply let his life, his example, and he talked about his background and his life, and he allowed that to make the case for him and his innocence. And that would settle any disputes. A little snippet of verse 2 and then verse 3. Then he said, that's verse 2, and then verse 3, I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, brought up in the city of the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God, as you all are today. So not only was he born from no mean city, or he was born from an important city in the eyes of the Romans, but on top of that, he was trained in Jerusalem, the place that all the Jews respected, at the feet of no one less than Gamaliel. This is the second time we read about Gamaliel. The first time he was introduced is in Acts 5, verse 34. You remember the Sanhedrin was deciding how to handle the apostles who taught the way of Christ. And really, they viewed the apostles and the early Christians as threats. They were threatening their religious influence. And Gamaliel used historical events of religious fanatics, and he talked about their downfall. And he told the Sanhedrin to wait, and Christianity would follow suit if it had was from man. It would follow suit like the rest of these things. From Acts 5, verse 34, we learn that he is a member of the Sanhedrin, that high council that was respected by all the Jews. But not on top of that, though, he was also a teacher, which means he was very trained in the law, and he could answer questions, he could settle disputes, even among the Sanhedrin. He could pull weight. And on top of that, he was respected within the group. You remember, he gave that advice and they all listened to him. He was a very well-respected man. Josephus writes about Gamaliel. Now, this is somewhat disputed, but anyways, Josephus had an idea of who Gamaliel was. And he said, Josephus describes the family of Gamaliel as very illustrious. Rabbinic literature pictures Gamaliel as the grandson of the great Hillel and the Pharisaic leader of the Sanhedrin. The honorific title, the elder, was bestowed upon him, as it was upon his father and his grandfather. So he came from a lineage that was even respected by the people. He was the first of only seven in all rabbinic history, however, to be distinguished rabban, which it means our teacher or master. He may thus be understood as the greatest living authority and most revered figure in all of Judaism from 80:20 to 50. Gamaliel was even consulted by royalty concerning matters of Jewish law. Gamaliel was the head of the school of Hillel, and he consistently ruled on matters of Jewish law in ways that translated in his moderate and pragmatism into day-to-day life. He was especially concerned with to ease the burden of women and the poor. His rulings were commonly based on the guiding principles of promotion of the common good and promoting the ways of peace. So, he was respected among the people, a very powerful and influential man, and Paul was trained by him. Paul had quite the pedigree. Not many Jews could top his background and his education. On top of that, he was once zealous of the law, just like all this audience was. Verses 4 and 5. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, as also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders, from whom I also received letters to the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring in chains even those who were there to Jerusalem to be punished. So not only was Paul zealous of the law, he was also a staunch defender of the law, the Jewish way, and the way that he was brought up. He used to also think that Christianity was a false religion and a threat that needed to be stamped out. He resorted to assisting in wiping out the Christian population. Paul did not have mercy on women. According to this verse, he would drag men and women. He was all about stamping them out, and he would kill them if they didn't blaspheme God and deny the faith of Christ. Acts 26, verse 10 and 11. Or verse 10, rather. This I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, and when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. Paul was not fabricating this past. According to verse 5 of our verses, he appeals to the high priest and the Sanhedrin. To a Jew, you could not appeal to a higher earthly authority as a witness. He is not making this up. He was on the way to Damascus to persecute more people. And then our verses stop right there. As we conclude, I just want to say during this transition point, as he's building up his comments, we're just kind of stopping here. But that tees up, hopefully, I think it's Mike next week to go from there and talk about that wonderful conversion experience, why Paul changed. But just a couple of takeaways. In many ways, we ought to look to Paul. We all know that, and we've stressed that many times as we've considered the book of Acts. But this is no different. One of the things that Paul did often in his preaching and also in his defense, this is an example of it, but he established common ground. Though his defense was not very successful at the end, they still were not satisfied with it. I think this was the best tactic that Paul could use. He appealed to their background and he said, I have the same background. I was trained just like you. And he had great education. And he established that common ground before he continued. Now, how do we take that home? Well, we can't always relate to everyone in every way. I think we can relate to everyone in some way because we're all human and we all need Christ. Some people we might be able to relate to more, but we ought to make an effort to try to make a connection with them, to actually, when we're telling them about the gospel, to really help them to understand that their need for Jesus Christ, that they need Jesus Christ just as we need Jesus Christ. And I think that's a powerful and effective tool as we're defending the faith and also as we are telling the truth of the gospel to others. But another thing to note as we're closing is Paul's sacrifice. We've mentioned that a lot. I think Matthew in, sermon on Acts was talking about Paul's, all the things that Paul went through, all the things he sacrificed for the cause of Christ. Think of, I'm just thinking about that because he's mentioning his background and I can't help but think of his pedigree. Most Jews wish that they could have the kind of advantages that Paul enjoyed growing up and being trained. He was on the fast track to a lifelong successful career. He was heading up their cause to stamp out Christianity. Imagine that, having that as your resume. He could have been respected by everyone for the rest of his life. He could have lived a life of ease, of power, of influence, of so many things of this earth that seem so compelling. He could have done all of that. But he changed. Why did he change? It's because Jesus changed his life. And I think that's a case for apologetics. When you think about Paul, you could say this about all of the apostles. Why would they leave their comfortable lives and live lives largely rejected? Yes, they turned the world upside down, but they also faced a lot of rejection. Paul gave up everything. He gave up his background, his education, the benefits of it, rather. And I'm sure that helped him in his life, rather. But you know what I mean. He didn't get to enjoy the type of career that could properly be enjoyed by that kind of background and bringing up. He gave it all up because Jesus really did live. Jesus did die. Jesus rose from the dead. And he is the way, the truth, and the life. And it was all worth it for Paul. Paul was willing to give that up for the name of Christ. In eternity, I know he's thinking this every minute. He's thinking it was all worth it. And that's the same message for us. It's worth it. It's worth being uncomfortable. It's worth standing up for the truth. It's worth not indulging all the pleasures of this season. I think of Moses when I think of his pedigree. He had it all, and he gave it up rather to suffer affliction rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Because in eternity, it's worth it. It's worth following after Christ. And I hope you can take those two pointers away and take this transition. I hope you're excited for the next week as he continues on in his trials. I hope this talk was helpful to you. We now want to extend the gospel invitation, that precious truth that Paul gave up his well-being for. He gave it up for Christ, and he offered that same offer of forgiveness of sins to everyone. We know that we must first believe in God, believe that Jesus was the Son of God. We must repent of our sins, make a change and follow after Jesus Christ, make that commitment. That's what you do. You've got to be ready to make that commitment. You must be confess that good confession that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and then you must be baptized for the remission of sins. At that time, you're added to the church and you have your sins washed away. If there's one who's taken these steps and who's fallen, why don't you come repenting of your sin, confessing it, and we'll have prayer. If there's one to be the case, please come as we stand and sing.